WSET level 2, factors influencing the style, 2A. We're looking at the key factors that affect the style and quality and price of a bottle of wine. And generally, the two we're going to focus on today are things like the grape variety itself and the environment that the grape's grown in. They're two pretty important things. In total, other things you need to think about are grape growing, winemaking, and maturation. And if you put a lot of those together, you often come up with what people often call terroir, which the French describe as a magical combination of sort of knowledge, grape varieties, and climate and regions, all that sort of stuff. Personally, I don't believe magic, so we're going to look at it from a more scientific approach. We're going to start off, though, by looking at the grape variety, and grapes themselves are pretty basic. They've got stalks to them, they've got the skin, which is very important because the skin produces some flavours. It also gives the wines colour. Red wines, the colour comes from the skins, and it also has the tannins. If you've ever tried a red wine that's been quite drying in your mouth, that's the tannins. In the middle, you've got your pulp, which is basically the fleshy centre. That's the bit most people actually like because it's got a lot of sugar to it. It's got the acidity in it as well. Most of the centre of a grape is actually water. Grapes are mainly water with little bits of sugar, acidity, tiny bits of flavour, and tiny amount of tannins and colour. Right in the centre of grapes are pips. Now, modern wine grapes you buy from the supermarkets are seedless, but the grapes that are used to make wines all contain seeds. And the problem with those seeds are they're often very tannic and they contain a lot of bitter oils. So when you're making wine, you want to make sure you don't crush them or destroy those seeds in any way, because that can impart quite a bitter, unpleasant flavour to the wine. Now, there are different types of grapes. Generally, the ones we use in wine are from a species of grape variety called Vitis vinifera. And you don't need to worry about that too much, but the key thing about it is that, and when a winemaker is trying to decide what grapes to varieties to grow, they need to choose specific grape varieties. And the grape varieties that people often use are things like Chardonnay, Pinot Noir, Cabernet Sauvignon, Riesling. Be careful to make sure you're aware of the difference between grape varieties and regions. A lot of European wine regions, often that's classed as the Old World, but Old World wine regions are normally named after the region. So things like Chablis, Champagne, Bordeaux, Chianti, Rioja, they're all physical places you can go and visit. They're not grape varieties in their own right. Grape varieties are your Chardonnays, your Pinot Noirs, your Grenaches, your Gamays. And the grape varieties themselves have got particular characteristics. For example, they'll have particular flavours. If you've ever tried a New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc, they're quite herbaceous, gooseberry, grapefruit flavours. Cabernet Sauvignon often has a sort of a blackcurrant flavour, or good Cabernet Sauvignons often have a blackcurrant flavour. Grenache often has sort of red fruit. So there's particular flavours that grapes produce. They also have particular characteristics. So, for example, Pinot Noir often has a thin skin. And if the colour comes from the skin, as we said earlier, then that means you often have light-coloured wines, not particularly high in tannins, because tannins come from the skins as well. Sauvignon Blanc often is naturally quite high in acidity, along with Chenin Blanc. Grenache is often high in alcohol, but not a lot of colour. So different grape varieties have different characteristics as well. So flavour and characteristics is one thing that a winemaker or a wine grower might consider. The yield is also very important. Some grape varieties yield very high levels. And when I'm talking about high levels, if you think of a grape variety like Trebbiano, which is a high-producing white grape variety from Italy, it can produce masses of yields. 100, 150 hectolitres per hectare is quite a big yield. Some can even get up to 200 hectolitres, so that's a massive yield. Whereas quality producers might restrict their yields down to maybe 30 hectolitres per hectare. Hectolitres is 100 litres, so it's what people sometimes use to describe the amount of yield that they're producing. Obviously, the more yield you produce, often the more neutral the wine is, but you're producing a lot more of it, so you can sell a lot cheaper, and sometimes the economics work in such a way that that's the way to go. You actually want to produce high-yielding, cheapish wines. That said, be careful. There is no absolute relationship between yield and quality and yield and price. That said, though, if you reduce your yield a lot, you can't sell your wines cheap. So while there's no particular relationship between yield and quality, there is a relationship between yield and price. Some grape varieties themselves are quite disease resistant as well. Some of them have thick skins that make them quite resistant to mold and mildews. Sometimes grapes have quite loose bunches, which means that the water tends to drain quite quickly, air circulating amongst the grapes. Sometimes the grape clusters are quite tight, which creates an opportunity for diseases to build in high humidity, which encourages mold and mildew. So there's a lot of things that the grapes can do in terms of managing mold and mildew if you choose the right grape variety. And lastly, probably the most important thing is climate. Different grape varieties like to grow at different climatic ranges. So, for example, Pinot Noir tends to like a quite cool climate, whereas Cabernet Sauvignon definitely likes it warmer. That's not to say that all grape varieties have the same climatic range. For example, even within a particular climatic range that Cabernet Sauvignon likes, if you're on the cooler end of that climatic range, you tend to get a slightly lighter style of wine, whereas if you're on the hotter end of the climatic range, you tend to get a heavier wine. So climate's quite an important thing, but the environment that the grapes grow is also quite important. In the WST Level 2, we divide climates generally into hot climates and cool climates. Hot climates tend to be more on the warmer side of most grape varieties, so you always find that hot climate wines tend to be more in alcohol, more tannins, less acidity, and therefore fuller body. If you've got more alcohol, more tannins, and less acidity, alcohol gives body to a wine, acidity takes away. Tannins tend to give body to a wine. So all those factors create a fuller-bodied wine. If you're in a cool climate, you tend to be on the cooler range of most climatic grape varieties. And you find that if a grape can be grown in a warm climate and a cool climate, the cooler climate grape variety will have less alcohol, because it just can't ripen the grapes up, you can't get the same level of sugar, less tannins, and the tannins may actually be a bit more astringent and a bit nasty, more acidity, the wine tends to be lower in alcohol, higher in acidity, and this creates a lighter bodied style of wine. England, it would be considered a cool climate, but things like Chablis, Burgundy, in northern France, these are all reasonably cool climates. Hot climate wines include places like Spain and North Africa. And also the inland areas of Australia can be quite hot, and some of the inland areas of California can also be quite hot. But other things do drive the climate. For example, if you're near the coast, you find that you get a cooling influence from the water, because water tends to keep things nice and moderate. In winter, it warms the area up, in summer, it keeps it cool. So being near a large pool of water, whether it be a lake or a coast, can moderate the climate a wee bit. But the key driver is often latitudes. And grapes typically grow between latitudes 30 and 50 degrees latitude. The closer you are to the cool 50 degrees, the cooler it is, closer to the poles. And the closer you are to the equator, like 30 degrees, the warmer it is. So you'll find that often grape varieties tend to grow at certain latitudes or certain climates as well. That's why we're called 30-50. If you ever wondered why we're called 30-50, it's because of that. The last thing to worry about is environmental factors. Things such as sunlight, which is always important. Sunlight is massively important. The more sunlight you get, the more energy you have, the more sugars that can be produced by the grape variety. And light density is quite important. If you get a torch and hold it straight down on a piece of ground, you'll see that you'll get a pure circle of area that's quite small. You hold the torch at an angle and it now creates an eclipse, which is a much larger area. Same amount of energy, but now over a greater area. Because the sun's generally not overhead, we don't tend to grow grapes on the equator, it's always on an angle, then if you can grow your grapes on the slope that faces towards the sun, you'll actually get more energy from it. So sunlight's quite important, and if you want more energy, you tend to be on a slope facing the sun. The other thing about slopes is it helps rainfall run away. And rainfall's quite important. If you're in a wet area, you don't want too much water going into the ground. So if you're on a slope, the rain will run away down the hill. Water, obviously, is an important element as well, because water combines with carbon dioxide in the vine's leaves to create sugars and most of the building material of a vine. Vines and grapes are mainly just carbon dioxide and water that's been converted through the use of sunlight. You do need nutrients, though, just little tiny bits of nutrients. People talk about potassium, nitrogen, all that sort of stuff. And there's a saying in wine, you know, treat them mean to keep them keen. And the idea there is that you need little bits of nutrients. And as long as you hit that minimum requirement, you don't need any more. And what you find is if you get too many nutrients in an area, that the vine will go into vegetative growth. It'll just grow like crazy, and it won't put any effort into growing grapes, and you won't get good quality grapes. Too much nutrients in your soil can be a problem. It can be managed, but it's more expensive to manage. So often, grapes are grown on pretty lean soils that aren't really good for much else, which is perfect for the grapes, perfect for the grower, and great for the environment because that soil wouldn't have been much use for growing other crops. The only other thing you need to consider from the environment really is warmth. Now, we talked about water bodies like the sea and lakes keeping things warm. Another thing that can keep an area warm is the soils. If you're on some stones, you find that often the stones will absorb heat during the day and then radiate the heat back as it gets cooler in the evenings. And then what that does is it helps keep the vineyard warmer and allows for ripening of the grapes. You can see this in places like Châteauneuf-du-Pape in southern Rhone, where the pudding stones are around. These big white stones heat up and then they radiate heat back. Or if you've ever walked along a wall, it was maybe vegetative growth, it was cool, you hit the stand beside a wall on a hot summer's day and you can feel the heat from those bricks radiating back. So if you've got stones in your vineyard, you'll find that's a bit warmer. If you've got clay or wet soils or something like that, then you'll find that keeps the vineyard a wee bit cooler. So the warmth is quite important in terms of ripening. You want to get the right amount of warmth. If it's too cold, the vines tend to stop growing. So normally most vines grow between 10 and 30 degrees Celsius. If you go much above 30 degrees, what tends to happen is the vines shut down. They stop photosynthesizing, and you'll see in some places like South Africa where the vines are a wee bit diseased and they don't really have the capacity to deal with high temperatures, you often get green flavors in these wines simply because the vines have stopped photosynthesizing because it's getting too hot for them. They can't deal with the temperature so much. So it's strange to think that warm climates can actually give unripe flavors. Similarly, if it gets too cold, the plant can't photosynthesize and that can't convert the oxygen in the water into sugars, which it needs. So you'll find that, you know, when you get below 10 degrees, no good. And that sort of helps set the limits of 30 to 50 degree latitudes that you see for most wines. The only other thing to worry about is the altitude is climate. It just gets cooler as you go up and higher in altitudes. If you've ever climbed mountains, they always say, make sure you dress up warm. The temperature drops about 0.65 degrees per 100 meters, or about 6 degrees if you're up a kilometer. Not many vineyards are up a kilometer. There's some in northern Italy, and Argentina has some pretty high vineyards as well. But that's 6.5 degrees if you're up a kilometer. That's quite a big difference in temperature. Now, just be careful about the difference in climate and weather. Climate are the environmental factors, water, the latitude, the slope, all those factors that you don't change from year to year. The climate sort of is your constant. But within a particular season, growing season, you can have different weather. So some years can be colder than the typical climate, and that's driven by the local weather. And you've got to be careful with weather, because weather includes things like rain, and if it rains at the wrong time of year, you can lose flowers, which means you may not get much grape harvest. Hail can be a nightmare in the vineyard. If it hails, it'll pierce the fruit, causing it to have diseases and put a lot of disease pressure on your vineyard. Frost is another really serious problem, particularly at the beginning of the season or at the end of the season. If you get frost at the beginning of the season, just as the vine's buds have burst and they're getting ready to grow, you can freeze the vine, kill off the buds and the flowers that you are hopefully going to have this year, and it can be a real nightmare in certain areas. And a lot of people spend a lot of time using things like windmills and heating oil cans up and all sorts of stuff. In New Zealand, they use helicopters to try and keep air circulating to stop the frost. Wind is also a problem. You've got breezes that blow through things like the Mistral in the Rhone Valley and the Doctor in South Africa that give different wind effects and can be a problem in terms of growing grapes or cooling effects, which is not necessarily a bad thing, but you've got to be careful about that. If you have a particularly wet year or a particularly hot year, then that will vary the vintage. Imagine if you've got a particularly wet year, lots of rain hits the ground, the vine soaks up all that water, the grapes swell up, and you'll get a very dilute set of flavors. If you've got a very hot year, the grapes tend to shrivel up a wee bit, have less moisture, so you'll get a super concentrations and probably really high alcohol, so a lot of big-bodied wines. A cold year, you might find you get lower alcohols, more acidity to the wine. So a particular year will have different weather, and that will create vintage variations. But the climate doesn't change from year to year. That's more driven by latitudes, slopes, all that sort of stuff. So just be a bit careful about that. The only thing I forgot to mention about soils earlier on is just be careful about soils. Some soils, like chalk and gravel, drain really easily. So even if you're in a particularly wet place, those soils will let lots of water through, and the grape vines won't get too wet. If you're in clay, it not only is clay a bit cooler and it's full of nutrients, which can be a good thing, clay will also mean that if you're in a wet area, the vines are going to get lots and lots and lots and lots of water, and they'll swell up with grapes that'll dilute the flavors, etc. The thing with wines is you need to grow the grapes, and the grapes grow on vines. And generally in viticulture, what you're looking for is the shape of the vine to make the best use of the sun and the heat and the energy and the water and the nutrients. And then you need to also control the number of grapes that are going to be produced or the number of bunches that are on the vine, and that will give you ripe, healthy grapes. The main ways of doing this is usually through trellising. Trellising is all about shaping the vine to do what you want, and it controls the position, the grape's exposure to the sun. So in a cooler climate, you may want to have the vine completely exposed to the sun so it gets maximum energy from the sun. In a hotter climate, you may want to actually protect the vine from that. And the way they do that is often in hotter climates, they might have a very large leaf canopy that shelters the vine, particularly if it's fairly dry and you don't need to worry about things like humidity. You might actually hide the grapes away under leaves, and that stops the leaves getting sunburn. Where it's very cold, you want to possibly expose the grapes as much as possible to the light, the sunlight, in which case, and if it's a bit cold, particularly if it's cold or if you're in a wet environment and you want to minimize the humidity around the grape cluster, you don't want molds and mildews growing on them, so you tend to expose the grapes to the sunlight. Exposing grapes helps develop thicker skins and more color, tannin, and flavor. Just like we go brown, grapes get thicker skin. So as we get sunburned or suntanned, hopefully we don't get sunburned, we go a bit brown, grapes will develop thicker skins, and that means you'll get more tannins, more color extracted from them. You also get more antioxidants. As you go up in altitude, such as places like Mendoza, you're quite high up. The UV protection is a lot thinner, and you find that grapes respond to all this extra sunlight that they get by forming quite thick skins with lots of antioxidants. There's lots of different types of trellising system, and I don't want to go into detail about them at this stage, just to be aware that there is a thing called trellising, and that does control a lot of the exposure to the grapes, etc. Managing the yield is quite an important part. The yield is controlled mainly by the number of buds left on the vine. The number of buds you get are based partly on how much sunlight the vine had the year before. What happens is a bud will have a bunch of grapes, hopefully, and it'll have a shoot going from it. If you trim the canes or the last year's growth, you can control how many buds that the vine has, and that'll control the potential yield. Lower yields often mean that you're going to produce less grapes, but WSD are quite obsessed with this. They think there's no absolute link between yield and quality. I think I mentioned last time that the lower the yield, you need to charge more for the bunches of wines, therefore the wine's going to be more expensive. As I say, higher price doesn't always have a particular relationship with yields. The other thing about lower yields are that the grapes do ripen slightly faster. If you have a vine and you grow 10 bunches versus 5 bunches, it takes longer. You need more nutrients, more sugars, more energy, etc., to ripen 10 grapes than you do 5 grapes. That's why in cooler climates such as England, northern France, they tend to grow quite low yields because they just don't have the energy and going into the vine to ripen big, big crops. Similarly, if you're in a really hot place, one of the ways to slow down the ripening of your grapes is to have massive yields. What you find often in the hot, dry climates is that's where a lot of the industrial production of wines come from, where they have big yields, but they can ripen them all up, whereas cooler areas, you can't ripen so many grapes. The other thing that manages yield is water. The more water you get, the more the grapes swell up with water. The more they swell up with water, the bigger they are, the more wine you get produced from the same number of bunches of grapes. One of the things that can have a fairly detrimental effect on your yield are things like pests and diseases. Now, pests such as birds and insects love grapes. In fact, the reason red grapes change color is so that the birds can see them. And when a grape's not ready to be eaten, i.e. the seeds aren't ready to be distributed, the seeds aren't ready to grow into new plants, they stay green. However, once the seeds are mature and ready to produce another plant, the grapevine wants to get those seeds distributed as quickly as possible, so it changes the colour of the grapes so the birds can see them. They go down, they eat them and carry the seeds miles away, and obviously when they pass through the bird, they land up on the ground and then they can grow a new vine. Birds and vines have got a nice symbiotic relationship. However, winemakers don't necessarily like birds because they eat all their lovely, lovely grapes. So a lot of vineyards do things to try and manage it. Some people try and scare birds away with big clappers that make a heck of a noise. Often bird netting is a way of doing it as well, where the birds are kept away from the grapes by putting nets over so they can't get into the grapes. Problem with netting is it does tend to raise the humidity under that netting canopy, and things like fungal diseases, molds, mildews, rot, all that sort of things can be a problem. Also, if you live in a wet environment where there's a lot of water around, you know, there's a lot of moisture in the air, either due to high humidity or just because it rains a lot, then molds and mildews can be a real problem. A lot of wineries spray to protect them. However, spraying costs money. So if you're in a wettish environment, you might have quite high yields because all the water there, the grapes have absorbed all that water, but you won't necessarily produce lots of cheap, high-quality grapes because you've got to constantly spray them to manage the molds and mildews. You do get things like funguses and viruses and bacteria. In fact, in South Africa, there's a lot of vines used to be quite infected with viruses. There's been a massive replanting in the last decade or so, but what would happen is the virus would get into the vine, and on a hot day, that the mixture of the virus and the temperature would cause the grapevine to shut down. It would stop photosynthesizing. And if a plant doesn't photosynthesize, then even though it's a hot summer's day, the grape will not ripen. And you used to get, and you still do a wee bit, quite green flavors from the grapes simply because the grapes haven't ripened enough. Whatever the issue, whether it's a fungal disease, a virus, bacteria, all these things will limit the quality of the grapes being produced. So a lot of vineyards spend a lot of time trying to manage these issues to try and produce good, healthy grape varieties. Once you've sprayed and protected your vine, you've got your yield right, and your grapes are grown and they're looking beautiful, they've changed colour and they're perfect for harvest, the next step is to harvest it. And there's generally two ways of harvesting it. You either do a manual harvest or a machine harvest. Manual harvests have a couple of advantages. First of all, if you want to, you can send your pickers through and they can just select whole bunches of grapes. Now, whole bunches of grapes, why are they interesting? Well, sometimes you want to make wines out of whole bunches of grapes. For example, carbonic maceration, which is a method of producing wine in Beaujolais, needs whole bunches to do that. Another advantage that you have with manual picking is sometimes with certain styles of wine, they may want to get particularly ripe grapes. This is quite common for things like Sauternes, where they have a mold, which sounds a bit strange, but they have a mold that grows on the grapes called botrytis. And that botrytis concentrates the sugars, acidity, and flavors by effectively allowing the grape to dry out. What happens is the botrytis sinks its little roots into the grape, and the holes that are made as the roots go in allows water to evaporate. If you remove water, you increase the concentration of flavors, sugars, and acidity, which means you can create these lovely concentrated wines. But when you're trying to make a really top Sauternes, you only want really, really heavily affected botrytis grapes, so you want to individually select them. In actual fact, in Germany, they have a style of wine called Trockenbeeren Auslese, and Trocken means dry, Berry means grape, and Auslese means late harvest, so dry late harvest. In other words, the wine's been so affected by this noble rot or botrytis that they're actually almost dry. So you need to make multiple passes through the vineyard to do that, so manual picking is the only way of doing that. Sometimes you can't do a machine harvesting because you can't get tractors in there. Think about vineyards in Germany and the Mosel. Again, the sides are so steep that you can't get tractors up there. The Northern Rhone Valley has a lot of steep hills, along with even Burgundy. So sometimes you just cannot machine harvest even if you wanted to. And the other thing you've got to be careful about manual harvesting is it costs labor. You need to employ people to do the picking. And as a result, your costs can go quite high. So manual harvesting is particularly useful for places where you want to produce high quality wines that specifically require manual harvesting, where countries have cheap labor. Machine harvesting is where a tractor-like product, quite often it straddles the vineyard, goes up and down the rows. And what it does is it clamps onto the vine and shakes and shakes and shakes. And as the grapes fall off, because they're ripe, they fall off the vine. You just get single grapes falling off, and they just tear off from the stem, and they fall, they get caught on a conveyor belt that then takes them onto a tractor with a trailer or whatever it is that's collecting the grapes. These grapes don't have the stalks, they're ripped open a wee bit as well, so oxygen potentially could get into these wines. So quite often with machine harvesting, you need to put things like sulfur dioxide, which is a preservative that stops the wine from oxidizing from getting onto it. Vineyards need to be designed for machine harvesting. So you need to have trellising that's in place that's designed for it. You also need things like posts in place that can take the harassment that all the shaking does. As well as that, you need to make sure that the vineyard can actually have tractors running up and down the rows. So when you design a vineyard and you plant it up, you need to think about it right from the outset. Obviously, you can't harvest on steep slopes because you can't get a tractor up the steep slopes. Okay, that finishes our look at some of the viticultural practices. So once the grapes have been harvested, they need to be made into wine. Now, as you can imagine, there's three colours to wine. Well, there's three main colours: red, white, and rosé. So we're going to cover the three main different processes that make these different coloured wines. One thing to be careful about, though, is that they all start with a basic alcoholic fermentation. That is, you take grape sugars in the juice, and with yeast, you convert it into alcohol. A bit of carbon dioxide is a byproduct, and heat. So grape sugars in the juice convert with yeast into carbon dioxide, alcohol, and heat. Now, the alcohol is something that we obviously like. Carbon dioxide normally vents off into the atmosphere and just helps global warming, so that's not really a problem. But heat can be a problem. Red wines are normally fermented a bit warmer, and white wines normally fermented a bit cooler. So you actually need to cool white wines down because all the heat that's being produced during the alcoholic fermentation. So temperature control can be a bit of an issue with alcoholic fermentation. Now, there is a subtle difference between commercial yeasts and wild fermentation. And that's something you need to just understand a wee bit. Wild fermentation is where a winemaker just does not add any yeast. So whatever yeast is on the grape skins or in the juice when it comes into the winery, or perhaps it picks up yeast from the winery, that's the yeast that's going to do most of the work converting the sugars into alcohol. Now, yeast is a massively important part of the winemaking process. If you ever taste a grape, you'll notice that the final wine that comes from that grape doesn't taste anything like the flavors in the grape. And that's because in the process of alcoholic fermentation, it converts a lot of precursor chemicals into aromatics. The yeast does that. So yeast can change the wine quite considerably. A lot of people think that the flavors come from the grapes. And it is true that the precursors are in the grapes, but the yeast is the thing that does a lot of the conversion into flavors, and the yeast can change the flavors quite considerably. And that's why some wineries get quite uptight about using commercial yeast, because you can effectively add flavors into the wine. You can make the wine taste more banana-y, you can make the wine taste more melony. So they think that it's better to use whatever yeast is in the vineyard at the time, because yeast is everywhere. Commercial yeasts are yeast that you buy. And what happens is you just add a load of yeast into the vat. And if you add enough yeast into the vat, you'll get a large population of yeast that will dominate the alcoholic fermentation, and any wild fermented yeast won't get a chance to get an edge in. Normally in a wild fermentation, you've got a load of different types of yeast. One yeast strain will eventually dominate all the other yeasts, but that process of all those different yeasts can make all sorts of different flavors. And people say you get a lot of complexity from it, and it's true. You can get some wines that don't have particularly nice flavors. For example, there's a yeast called Brettanomyces that's a stray yeast, and that can create really dodgy smells of sometimes farmyard, leathery type smells that sometimes aren't that pleasant. Some people love them, some people don't. So yeast is quite an important part of the alcoholic fermentation, and it's the thing that converts the sugars into alcohol, but can have a massive influence on flavor. Now, let's start with white wine making. With white wine making, you start off with the grapes, and the grapes can be white wine grapes, red wine grapes, it doesn't matter, you can use any type of grape. The key thing is you get your grapes and you crush them. And the idea of crushing them is it breaks up the skins and it allows the juice to get out. Then very quickly, you normally press the juice. That separates the juice from the skins, and you do that quite quickly. Usually you don't really want the juice in contact with the skins because it'll pick up flavors, and if you've got red skins, for example, it'll pick up the red color. So generally, if you crush them and press them very quickly, then you'll just get the juice, which will be reasonably clear and will be suitable for making white wines. Then you either add your yeast if you're using commercial yeast, or you let the alcoholic fermentation just start normally. And you can do that in all sorts of vessels. Some people do them in stainless steel, and a lot of white wine is made in stainless steel because stainless steel is inert. Some people like to do it in wood, so oak barrels, and concrete's also used. Sometimes people just put them into big square holes that are dug in the ground with lined with concrete. Some people have been getting really trendy into these funny egg-shaped
concrete vats as well these days. So people get quite excited about the different fermentation vessels. The key thing with white wines is you don't normally want the fermentation to be too warm. Usually 12 to 22 degrees is quite common. Now, the type of vessel you use, stainless steel, wood or concrete, will also have a big impact on the temperature that the wine ferments at. Stainless steel, the nice thing about stainless steel is you can wrap it up with coolant, so you can have a lot of control. You can warm it up, you can chill down the tank, so you've got a lot of control over the temperature. Wooden barrels are usually sort of 225-litre barriques. They're the sort of classic barrels that you see a lot. Different regions have different size barrels, but about that size, 225-ish litres. And the thing about that is it's got lots of surface area for the amount of wine, so you find that the barrel itself will warm up a wee bit, but hopefully the centre of the barrel won't get too hot. If you have a really, 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 really big barrel, what you find is you've got a lot of wine that's going out undergoing alcoholic fermentation, and a lot, very small surface area with big barrels, and that means that you will land up with quite high fermentation temperatures. Concrete, again, it's harder to chill a concrete. Some people dip stuff into the concrete tank to try and chill it down or warm it up, but concrete tanks are a wee bit harder to control the temperature. Perhaps one of the great innovations in modern times was the chilled stainless steel tank, and that allows styles like New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc to sort of be created, because up till then, if you fermented too high a temperature, you lost a lot of those lovely aromatics that are quite common with wines like Sauvignon Blanc. Anyway, after you've done the alcoholic fermentation, you're really pretty much to go with your wine. Normally you'll filter out the dead yeast, you'll filter out any skins that might have been left in the tank, etc. But that's it pretty much for white wine. Red wine making, wee bit different. At this time you must start with black grapes. Sometimes people will have black grapes and white grapes blended in, but generally you need black grapes. Again, you crush the grapes to break up the skins. But now, instead of pressing the juice off the skins straight away, you leave the skins in contact with the juice, and you allow the alcoholic fermentation to occur. Alcoholic fermentation is normally a wee bit warmer, 20 to 32 degrees. And the longer you leave the alcoholic fermentation, the more time there is for the tannins and the colour that are in the skins to leach from the skins into the juice. That's the reason why you leave the juice in contact with the skins during the fermentation, because the longer you leave it, the more tannins, more colour that comes from the skins. Also, you get a bit more flavour from the skins as well. As the alcohol level rises during the fermentation, as it's in contact with the skins, what you find is alcohol acts as a solvent, and that extracts more colour, more tannins, and more flavours. And you'll often find that wines from warmer climates often have higher alcohols, and they can extract more colour from the tannins. One of the things you've got to be worried about when you're doing this alcoholic fermentation is as the yeast gobbles up the sugar and converts it to alcohol, it produces carbon dioxide. And all these little tiny, tiny bubbles of carbon dioxide tend to rise to the surface. And as they rise, they often trap little bits of skin, and they push up the little bits of skin. And what you find is when you're doing an alcoholic fermentation with red wines, you get this big mass of skin that tends to form on the top of the wine. Now, if you're trying to give lots of skin contact, that's no good, because all the skin's not really touching the wine. So you find that people have to punch down the skin. They get these big fat bats and they just push it down. Sometimes they'll pump wine over the top. So they take wine from the bottom of the tank and they pump it to the top of the tank, and then it percolates back down through the skins and hopefully push the skins all the way down. So getting the skins in contact will increase the extraction of the colours, tannins and flavours. Now, after the alcoholic fermentation is finished, and you may leave the juice in contact with that sort of wine for a bit longer just to get a bit more tannins and colour out of there, you need to get the wine off the skins. The first thing you'd normally do is rack and return. That is, you drain the wine off from the bottom and you just put it into a clean tank. You let that settle down and let all the sediment come out of the wine, and then you'll drain it off again and return it maybe back to the original tank, which you've cleaned out a lot of the dead skins, etc. Now, there's still some wine in that skin. What you'll often do is take all that skin and seeds and all that sort of stuff, put it in a press and squeeze it. By pressing the skins, you're going to extract a bit more wine out of it. You've got to be careful though. If you press too hard, you squeeze everything too hard, you'll actually rupture the seeds
And the seeds are full of bitter oils. And if you squeeze too hard, you'll get a lot of bitterness in the wine. Sometimes you want to press quite gently. Sometimes, you know, if you want to make a lot of wine, or you want some wine with a lot of flavor and tannins and maybe a bit of bitterness, astringency, squeeze it really hard and get lots and lots and lots and lots of juice out of that skin. Whatever it is, at the end of the day, you're going to land up with free-run juice, which is just juice that's just come away quite cleanly and easily. And then you're going to get pressed juice. And then you'll either blend the two together, or you might have them separately. It just depends on how you're going to blend your wines and how you're going to make your wines. Well, the other thing to watch out for, we talked about this with viticulture, is that hotter countries often have more skin. You know, they produce more skin in response to the sun. They also have higher alcohols. Alcohol's a solvent. So you often find that hotter countries, because they're more skin, higher alcohols, they often have more color, more tannins, and more flavor. So when you're looking at a wine, if it's very, very, very pale, that may tell you that the wine's actually coming from a cooler climate, where a very dense, deep-coloured wine may give you an indication that the wine comes from a hotter climate. Now, the third type of winemaking is called rosé winemaking. And I'm often a bit disparaging to rosé wines. I often say a rosé wine is a red wine that didn't quite make it. And it's sort of true, not necessarily wholeheartedly true. What you do is you start off with black grapes. You need the skins from the red grapes to give you the colour. You crush the grapes to break up the skins. And then you let the wine ferment. Again, either inoculated yeast or wild fermentation. It's up to the winemaker. But this time the fermentation only lasts for about 12 to 36 hours. So it's quite a short period of time. If you allow the fermentation to last for a week, maybe 2 weeks, you'll end up with red wine. Give it 12 to 36 hours, you'll end up with the rosé wine. Once the fermentation's finished, you drain the wine off the skins and maybe press the skins, and there you go. In the EU, it's illegal to blend white wine with red wine to make rosé wines. It's generally considered illegal. In actual fact, a lot of champagne rosé is actually made by just blending red wine and white wines together. It is allowed in other countries, but it's generally considered illegal in the EU. Anyway, that finishes up looking at how wine's made, maturing in oak barrels, etc. Oak. A lot of people get confused about what oak is and all that. If you look at oak and oak barrels, there's two parts. There's the flavour you get from the oak, and then there's the maturation in the oak, and that's influence of oxygen, really. So with new oak, what you get is oak imparts flavour to a wine. A lot of people in the wine industry think that adding flavours to wine is a no-no. They all say that right at the point where they start adding flavours using oak. And oak can be added either in a number of ways. You can add chips to the wine, you can add sawdust, you can add staves, which are sort of planks of wood, or you can put the wine into oak barrels. Now, a lot of people would say, well, oak barrel is the traditional method, that's the best way to go. The Aussies revolutionized a lot of what people think of as oak flavors in the 2000s with their big oaky Chardonnays. There they generally used oak chips, and they managed to get masses of oak flavors, which initially were quite appealing to a lot of people, particularly if you've never had oak influence in your wine before, or not a lot of it. All of a sudden you've got these wines with massive amounts of oak and high alcohol, and people were loving them. But there's nothing more unfashionable than last week's fashion, so the Australians are now moving to less oaky styles of wines. What happens is that as the wine is in contact with oak, as it be staves, chips or barrels, large or small, the flavours leach from the barrel into the wine. In fact, tannins also leach from the barrels into the wine. So when the wine's touching new oak, you get flavours such as toast, nuts, coconut and vanilla. And the problem is, if you use things like oak barrels, they're quite expensive. An oak barrel will add around 60 pence to a bottle of wine. If you're trying to make a very cheap bottle of wine, you can't add that sort of cost to it, because the wine itself might come to 5-10 pence. You add 60p to the wine, it's just not going to do it. And also, for a wine to be able to take oak, because oak can be quite dominating, particularly if it's a lot of new oak, you get a lot of flavour coming out. You may not have the fruit to support it. So what you generally find is it's the more expensive wines that have a lot of oak influence, because they've got the fruit to support that oak. If you don't want to spend lots of money on it, but you want a little bit of oaky flavour, then chips and staves are a lot cheaper. You can dangle them, and because staves and chips have a lot more surface area for the oak, you get a lot more flavour being imparted into the wine quite quickly and really cheaply as well. Hence the Aussie oaky Chardonnays that we saw 13, 15 years ago. You often find there's generally two main styles of oak. People talk about French oak and American oak.
And there's reasons why they're different. They're a slightly different tree. But French oak often give a nuts and vanilla flavor to the wine. So if you're tasting a wine that's got a lot of nutty flavors to it, or vanilla, then you immediately think French oak. And American oak often gives a lot of coconut flavors to a wine. So coconut and vanilla are often associated with American oak. As a general rule of thumb, red wines are made in stainless steel tanks or concrete vats, etc., something fairly inert where they can control the temperature. And white wines are either done in stainless steel concrete vats, or you can actually barrel ferment white wines. Now, you don't normally barrel ferment red wines, and that's partly for two reasons. Partly temperature control, but the main one is the fact that normally the juice is in contact with the skins, and you're constantly pumping over or pushing down that cap of skins to get the color in contact with the juice. With oak barrels, you can't really control the skin contact that well, so you don't tend to barrel ferment red wines, but you do barrel ferment white wines, and particularly Burgundy, quite famous region for barrel fermented Chardonnays, and that's where you often get these nutty aromas coming through. Now, it's not just about the flavors from oak barrels. One of the things to bear in mind is that oak barrels and oak chips will give up their flavor quite readily to the wine, and the longer the wine's in oak, the less the flavor comes. In actual fact, people talk about how barrels are used maybe the first year or second year, and they talk about the percentage of new oak versus old oak barrels. Because the older oak barrels have given up a lot of their flavor, and so they don't have so much influence on the flavor, but oak also, particularly oak barrels, allow oxygen to seep in through the barrels. And this micro-oxidization is quite important to wines. It helps maturing the wines. Wines that never see any oxygen are often quite fruit-driven, quite, you know, showy, but they tend not to be particularly stable to oak. So what you find is wines that haven't really been aged in old oak or any type of oak often will not age for any length of time because they're not particularly stable to oxygen. Whereas if you put a wine into an oak barrel or give it some oxygen when it's maturing, then what you find is you lose a bit of fruitiness, but the wine becomes a lot more stable. The oxygen gets in there, it'll soften the acidity as well, and it helps soften out the tannins as well. So putting a wine in an oak barrel not only gives it flavor, but also softens. Now, you will see some flavors associated with oxygen, and these can sometimes be associated with barrels, but a lot of the effects are actually oxygen. So you sometimes see wines that have got some toffee in them, fig, hazelnut, and coffee. And these flavors are often associated with oxygen as opposed to the sort of raw vanilla or coconutty flavors that you get with just oak by itself. Now, you do get different types of barrels, different size barrels. Big barrels have got smaller surface area for the amount of wine they contain, whereas smaller barrels have more surface area, that's the oak touching the wine, for the amount of wine in the barrel. What you normally expect is bigger barrels mature the wine, they have less influence on the amount of flavor from the oak and also the oxygen getting into the wine, whereas smaller barrels, often these are things like barrique, 225 liter barrels, these smaller barriques have a much bigger influence in terms of the oxygen and the flavors from the oak. You don't necessarily have to mature or store wines in oak barrels. A lot of wines are stored in stainless steel tanks for short-term storage. The steel doesn't interact with the wine, and also there's no oxygen getting in there normally. You can micro-oxidize a wine by bubbling tiny little bits of oxygen through. That can have a similar effect as letting oxygen seep in through the wood in a barrel. But generally, if you don't go through that extra effort, leaving a wine in a stainless steel tank is pretty neutral to the wine. Once the wine has been bottled, once you're ready to bottle the wine, you normally put the wine into glass bottles. Now, glass is inert, but the cork at the end usually will allow oxygen to seep in. So what you'll find is that the cork seeps oxygen and the wine matures, and it can mature into some funky savory aromas such as cooked fruit, wet leaves, mushroom, leather, barnyard, savory characteristics. And these aged savory characteristics partly due to the oxygen, partly due to chemical reactions that are occurring in the wine. Screw caps, they allow very, 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 very tiny amounts of oxygen into the wine. And because the oxygen is not getting into the wine, they mature at a much slower rate. You find that the wines take longer to develop savory characters. And you also find things like the tannins and the acidity, which normally soften as oxygen is introduced into the wine, the wine stays fresher and more vibrant for longer. So screw caps are actually quite a good alternative if you're trying to make a young, fresh wine, because it'll keep it in that state for longer than a corked wine. One thing to remember about wines that age, not all wines age gracefully. In fact, my father-in-law once gave me a bottle of wine from the 60s that he'd been keeping for 40, 50 years. It was almost certainly a pretty cheap bottle of Plonk when he bought it, and it was certainly pretty awful when we drank it. So not all wine ages. Some wines age really well, and they develop these savory characteristics, and the acids and tannins back off. But a lot of wines don't, and they just fall apart. They lose fruit, and nothing really interesting happens. So just be careful about that. The only way to know if a wine's going to develop into something interesting is normally by looking at the producer's history. Have wines from this vineyard in the past developed into interesting wines? And if they have, great. And if they haven't, then it's unlikely that a particular wine will develop into something interesting. That said, though, be careful. There's a lot of wines that will age brilliantly. You can buy some Semillons from Hunter Valley that age beautifully, and they're relatively cheap. So you don't necessarily have to spend a lot of money to get a wine that has great ageability, but it's very hard to guess what a wine's going to be aged like simply by tasting it. If the wine's got bags of acidity, bags of tannins, then you know it's going to age slowly because they're like preservatives that will preserve the wine from aging quickly, but you may not know if they develop some interesting flavors as they age. Okay, that ends looking at maturing in oak barrels, etc. Okay, let's move on. Next up, we're going to finish up just looking at the cost of production. Now, in the WSET courses, cost of production isn't a requirement anymore. It used to be, but it's not a requirement anymore. They do encourage lecturers to continue talking about it because it does make an important element in terms of understanding wine and wine pricing. So I'm going to use some of the material I use in some of our normal tastings as opposed to a lot of the WSET material. But you do need to think about the cost of production in terms of a couple of things: vineyards, the winery, and packaging and distribution. Now, vineyards we've talked about in terms of yields, and obviously the more grapes you pull off a chunk of land, the less you need to charge per hectare for the wine produced off that land. Yields are quite important in terms of increasing the amount of money you make and or decreasing the amount of money if you don't produce much wine, and therefore that has a material effect on the production of the wine. Not necessarily the cost, just a little bit on cost, but more in terms of how much wine you make to sell. Labor and machinery, and we talked about machinery costs, mechanical harvesting, the new optical sorting tables have high capital costs, but they allow for a larger production. What you need to worry about here is if you're in an environment where the cost of labor is very cheap, then you don't need to invest in mechanical harvesting or mechanical sorting because you can just use people to do it. And people are very, very clever compared to machines, so it's not a problem for that. In the winery, we've talked a bit about oak barrels adding cost to the wine. They add about 60 pence to a bottle of wine these days. You need storage space and equipment. We talked about plunging caps. You know, red wines, you need to plunge the cap down. Sometimes people use pumps to pump the wine over, big stainless steel tanks. Pumps are very important in wineries. Filtering, quite important in wineries as well. So there's a lot of issues associated in the winery in terms of equipment. The last area is packaging and distribution. Bottles are expensive. The corks are expensive. The capsules are expensive. The wine are making the labels are expensive. In fact, label, depending on the quality of the label, we've done a number of podcasts looking at labels, etc. You know, they can cost from pennies up to 5-10 pence for a label. Similar prices for bottles, similar prices for corks or screw caps. So there's a lot of cost in terms of packaging. But even after you've done that and you've made the wine, you've got it, you've made the wine, it's in its bottle, it's packaged up with your logos, it looks beautiful, you still need to get the wine to market. And if you're producing wines for foreign markets, you've got to deal with things like exchange rates. And some people hedge your exchange rates, so they sort of give up a bit of money now to make sure they've got longer term knowledge about what the exchange rate will be. You've got to get the wine to market, and that could involve transporting it. We've done interviews in the past looking at shipping of wines all over the world. And then when you finally get to the market, you've got to pay taxes and levies. If you look at a bottle of wine, what we're going to do is look at a cost of a 4 quid bottle of wine in the UK market. In the UK, as of the second half of 2013, the duty rate on a typical bottle of wine is £2. VAT, which is a tax that you have to pay, and you have to pay that on the other tax as well, is 20%.
And if you assume the markup in a bottle of wine is around 30%, now this is for the internet type of pricing, 30%. Some people go as high as 40%. Certainly supermarkets can creep up a bit more as well because they've got economies of scale. But if you work on 30%, which is sort of the entry level for most wine to be sold, maybe 35% is quite common. And you look at the breakdown of a 4-quid bottle of wine, so £2 for duty. Shipping cost, if we allow for about 20 pence to ship a bottle of wine anywhere in the world, that's about right. If you're shipping from Australia, Chile, New Zealand, generally the wines are coming in by container and they're coming in quite cheap. If they're coming from places like France or Italy into the UK, that's normally shipped by road, which is quite expensive per mile. So 20p is about right, irrespective of whether it's coming from anywhere in the world. If you're worried about carbon miles and all that sort of stuff, just remember it uses more carbon to ship a bottle of wine from the Rhone Valley than it does from Australia. So that's something to consider. People don't realise how much carbon is used in trucking wines around through Europe. But 20p shipping costs. We said the markup's going to be 30%, so on a 4-quid bottle of wine, it works out, if you do the maths, about 92 pence. VAT on 4-quid bottle of wine is 66 pence or 67 pence, and that gives a grand total of fixed costs, there's nothing you can do about, of £3.79. That leaves 21 pence for the maker, the winemaker, to produce it, a kilo of grapes, harvest them, spray it, manage it, make the wine, bottle it, label it. In other words, they get hardly any money on a 4-quid bottle of wine. What does this mean? That means if you're going to make 4-quid bottles of wine economically, you have to make lots of it. You have to have an industrial scale and you have to be absolutely focused on high volume, cheap wine. If you look at the numbers on a 5-quid bottle of wine, the duty is still £2, the shipping is still 20 pence, the markup has creeped up now to £1.15, the VAT is 83 pence, giving a grand total of £4.19. That leaves 81p profit for the winemaker. So going from a 4-quid bottle of wine where they get 21 pence to a 5-quid bottle of wine getting 81 pence is a massive 4 times increase in the amount of money that the winemaker gets. What does that mean? That means they can reduce yields a wee bit, perhaps. They can spray a bit more so they get less diseased fruit coming into the winery. You'd expect cleaner wines. Maybe they've got a bit more money to invest in equipment so they have slightly better equipment as well. So I always tell people, if you can afford a 5-quid bottle of wine, please go for a 5-quid bottle of wine. If you like something that's under 5 quid and you're a bit tight, fair enough. But at 5 quid, the winemaker's starting to get a wee bit of money to grow that kilo of grapes. And just remember, that kilo of grapes, normally you go to the supermarket to buy a kilo of grapes and you'll pay, what, 7, 8, 10 quid for a kilo of grapes? Wineries get 21p, 81p for a 5-quid bottle of wine for a kilo of grapes. And then they've got to add all this additional value add, like making the wine and labelling it. So it's amazing. I've always been amazed at how much grapes cost in the supermarket versus how much they cost if you buy them in wine form. If we look at an 8-quid bottle of wine, you do the maths on that, the total cost comes to £5.38, which means the winemaker gets £2.62. At 10 quid, the winemaker gets £3.83. 20 quid, they get £9.85. So what you see is that at the bottom end, the tax take makes a significant proportion of the money taken on a bottle of wine. And when you get over to about 10 quid, the tax take becomes significantly less and the amount of money spent on the wine goes up significantly. I always tell people if the sweet spot for wine, if you can afford it, is between £5 and £12, really. There's not much point going much over £12 because your law of diminishing returns increases. So you start paying a lot more for the wine, but you get less and less increase in the quality of wine. Whereas between 5 and 12 quid, bang, for every buck you get a massive increase because the tax is so skewed to the cheap end of the wines because it's just 2 quid in the UK. Okay, that finishes looking up at the cost of production and where the money goes on a bottle of wine. Next week, we're going to start looking at things like labelling. I'll try and get our head around some of the European labelling terms, geographical indicators, all that sort of stuff.